So welcome to another edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, coming at you on the stream of free radio at freakradio.org, archived and live, if you happen to be watching or listening, I should say, on the 23rd of May, 2019. Not quite sure what I'm going to be putting up today, except a kind of interviews, possibly a bit from Justin Cummings' colloquy with the Santa Cruz neighbors, which was about a week ago. And there was no meeting with the West Side neighbors on Tuesday, as we thought. They postponed it until the 28th. For all of you West Side neighbor fans who want to get in on their strategy for driving away RVs, it should be, if they don't postpone it again, on the 28th of May, Tuesday, at the Santa Cruz Community Room of the police station at 5 o'clock. So I'll be checking in again on Sunday to see if that's the case. But you have to check in, too. I suggest you contact your friendly local police department and ask them if their room is booked for Tuesday at 5 o'clock on the 28th by the West Side neighbors, because they're the ones that supposedly are doing it. And the police department has been reasonably accurate in giving me that kind of information in the past. A year or two ago was National Police Week, and there was a photo on, I don't know if it's Andy Mills' Facebook page or Take Back Santa Cruz's Facebook page, but it had Andy Mills, chief of police, some of his lieutenants like Martinez and other high-ranking officers, and a sort of a fond embrace, well, a friendly lineup with Annalisa Cube, the head of Take Back Santa Cruz. I should say at least the co-founder. I assume she's still with that group. And I mention it because the police department doesn't have the right to associate with whoever they want. And Annalisa Cube doesn't have the right to associate with the police. They all do. Nor is anyone guilty of anything other than the fact that Take Back Santa Cruz is a notorious group for its anti-homeless legislative agenda, which it has pressed, and the people it has elected, Hillary Bryant, Lynn Robinson, Rochelle Narayan, backing, I don't know if they've actually endorsed Cynthia Matthews. They certainly should have if they haven't already. She was Take Back Santa Cruz before it was Take Back Santa Cruz. Have all these folks together on a sort of a public, I'd say kind of on the public dime, because when the mayor has a proclamation about National Police Week but refuses to have a proclamation about Food Not Bombs' 39th anniversary, which is coming up tomorrow for all you folks, I want to remind you, check out the Resource Center for Nonviolence at 610 Ocean Street at 6 o'clock and going till 10, and who knows, maybe later. It's a party and a street party. It's doors will be opening at 6, as I said. There's a suggested donation of $5 to $20, but no one turned away for lack of money, which is, of course, very Food Not Bombs-ish. DNA, Gina Rene, Danny Paul Nelson, Roberta Perala, The Raging Grannies, and Lyrical Eye, at least I recognize the last two, will be playing there. It's going to be celebrating 9 years of feeding social movements and the hunger and the Hungry at the Soupstock Festival, as they're calling it. That's tomorrow, May 24th. And last time, the 20th anniversary, I guess that was 19 years ago, drew nearly 20,000 people, according to this advertisement on IndieBay.org or announcement. And I'll be reading a little bit more from their blurb for Soupstock 2019, which you can also find on Facebook as we get into the show. So stay tuned for that and my usual round of caustic commentary. There is a shitty council meeting coming up on Tuesday, as well as a Board of Stupid Vipers meeting, supervisors, if you will. This council comes up in the afternoon and evening, assuming they're having an evening session, and the supervisors comes up, starts at 9, usually in the morning on Tuesday, goes until 4 thereabouts. But we don't have the agenda until Friday, usually, so I can't really tell you much about that, though I may be back on Sunday in my 9:30 show to give you more information. So let's get into it.
I'm tired. tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So let's begin by jumping to Berkeley, because we haven't been there much in the last few shows. I'm going to be quoting from a story that I picked up off the internet, actually a couple of them, about an ongoing trial that's happening up there around the group First They Came for the Homeless. A courthouse news service, and the headline is, Berkeley denies mistreating homeless as retaliation for protests. And actually, one of the witnesses was our old friend, if you've been following these broadcasts, Mike Zint, who is one of the founders of First They Came for the Homeless, which developed out of the Occupy San Francisco group way back in 2011 and began traveling around Berkeley half a dozen years later as part of the poverty tour, where they essentially would go to a park, set up their camp, their tents, be there as long as they could when the police came to remove them, although there were no adequate shelters in Berkeley and still aren't. They would sometimes lose their property, sometimes take their property with them, move to another park, another green area, another median space between two roads, set up camp, similar to what was done with Dignity Village up in Portland, Oregon. And ultimately, they found themselves on the edge of town at where Adeline Street hits Oakland, and they set up camp there, and they were left alone for almost a year. Then harassed again. The city actually put in a porta potty after much pressure from them and from other members in the community. But recently, the city has begun enforcing anti-homeless laws against them. And this is actually, the lawsuit is a follow-up from police action against First They Came for the Homeless several years ago, which they claim violates their First Amendment rights. They claim they were being harassed not for camping, but because of their protests against the city's policies, which were to drive the homeless out of sight and out of town, like in Santa Cruz. Here's some more of that story. It's from San Francisco Courthouse News. The city of Berkeley targeted homeless campers because they settled in disruptive locations, smeared feces on City Hall, and wrote suicide messages on sidewalks. Not because they were protesting City Hall policies, a city attorney told jurors Monday. Now, you may remember, the city attorneys are the people that defend indefensible policies in cities against poor and homeless people. And you saw this most recently, if you've been following Santa Cruz politics, with Reed Galagly, who is the assistant city attorney, or one of them, in Santa Cruz. And he lied on the stand, along with Susie O'Hara, regarding adequate shelter spaces, or tried to mislead the community around that issue. And then he attempted to smear one of the council members who testified otherwise, and also testified in favor of, and actually gave a declaration in favor of, those who wanted to stop the Ross camp from being destroyed so that people would not be flooding into the community all over the place with no shelter, which is what the city authorities under city manager Martine Bernal were trying to do, and effectively did a couple of weeks ago, essentially creating space for about 60 of them over at the River Street, very expensive barbed wire boneyard encampment, and letting a few folks into the 7th Avenue winter shelter, which was extended until June 30th, as was the River Street campground. And then also for families and for women and children, the Laurel Street. And that all that amounted to maybe 120 spaces, maybe a little more, if you assume that everybody else gets kicked out or excluded which, and since there are 1,000 to 2,000 homeless people in Santa Cruz, a figure that I imagine is familiar to most of you listening, at least you know that's my figure for the folks in Santa Cruz. But I repeat it anyway, because who knows? Might be a new person listening to this broadcast, and it's something the news media almost always omits when it talks about, oh, we're so happy they got rid of that unsightly Ross Camp, that great public nuisance, that great health hazard, that needle mania place, that slant on the campground, which is what you get from mainstream media and from the bigot-compliant, bigot-enabling Santa Cruz City Council, and most importantly, the Santa Cruz City staff, which really runs things in Santa Cruz government-wise. All this little takeoff or riff on the city attorneys. I don't have a lot of respect for city attorneys. I think I've only known one that I had any respect for, a Santa Monica city attorney from 40 years ago, Myers, who actually resigned rather than enforce anti-homeless laws in the late 80s in Santa Monica. Continuing with the story, Berkeley Deputy City Attorney Lynn Borgalt shared the city's narrative in an opening statement on the first day of trial in a lawsuit claiming the city selectively targeted homeless campers for evictions and destroyed their property because of their speech. Borgalt told the 8-member jury that homeless campers chose to pitch tents in troublesome places to pick a fight with the city. I would say perhaps to expose the city's lack of shelter. And if that means you have to be confrontational about it, yeah, around an issue that impacted the entire community and was a matter of the right to give free speech and to express those views. In fact, important for the Berkeley community to know, because if you don't provide shelter or you don't give people a way of at least establishing their own shelter in reasonable areas where they can support each other in self-managed communities, then they'll do it where they have to, where they can, where they must. And that can be uncomfortable for the people whose homes are nearby. It can be uncomfortable for the homeless themselves. It doesn't necessarily allow for sanitation facilities, particularly since for-profit businesses and bigoted city agencies, as we've seen in Santa Cruz, shut down their bathrooms, as Loudoun Nelson has done for the last year, or City Hall has done for the last 3 years here in Santa Cruz. Ross Dress for Less did, even for its customers, when one of our Huff members went in to use the bathroom. She was an elderly woman. She had a medical problem. They wouldn't let her do it. She literally shat her pants. And it really humiliated and horrified her, and actually maybe encouraged her to become an activist. In 2015, a group called First They Came for the Homeless, I think they may have been founded before then, but I'm not sure, organized multiple drug-free encampments in prominent spots around Berkeley to raise awareness about homelessness and affordable housing issues. And of course, not to mention to have places for people to live who are homeless, since I don't think anybody in those encampments is living there by choice because they have an option to be indoors. In fact, they actually serve as transitional encampments to some indoor living places, though not a lot of people get indoors from encampments, not because the encampments aren't successful, but because the housing isn't available. Berkeley police cleared the group's encampments, the story continues, 12 times in 3 months. Actually, I think it was more like 17 times. Maybe that was in a larger number of months. Between October 2016 and January 2017, while leaving other camps in place. A Berkeley police operations plan also established a goal of, quote, deterring the group from, quote, establishing an illegal encampment on city property. Of course, any encampment on any city property is illegal in Berkeley, as it is in Santa Cruz. Being poor and visible and going to sleep at night is illegal. Now, you might say to me, well, wait a minute, isn't there a court decision over Idaho Way, Boise v. Martin, that says that ain't the case, that you can't go after people who are homeless for violating the sleeping ban and camping ordinances if you ain't got place for them to live? And the answer is that's what the court said, but the Berkeley and Santa Cruz police do it anyway using other ordinances. And, of course, this lawsuit dates back to 2017, before the actual formal implementation of the September 2018 Boise versus Martin decision. Despite that evidence, Borgholt, the city attorney, told jurors the group tried to provoke the city by camping in the most inappropriate locations, including on sidewalks, street medians, across from a public high school, and on the steps of City Hall. Of course, you camp on the steps of City Hall because you are trying to make the point that they need to take some action on some issues. We've done that repeatedly, so if homeless in other cities, it's not at all inappropriate. In fact, it's probably the most appropriate place, the city, the center of government. Sidewalks are one of the places it's legal to be when they've closed off all other areas at night. Street medians are also places where there's some kind of grassy area in Berkeley anyway. And across from a public high school, well, the public high school in Berkeley occupies a number of blocks, and I don't know what their rationale for camping there was, but I don't see that that necessarily corrupts a public high school. In fact, it may educate some of the high school students as to what's going on. They picked these locations, the city city attorney says, so that they could turn around and accuse the city of targeting them to create a narrative that the city of Berkeley treats homeless people like trash. See, the city is just the victim in the mind of, or at least in the words, of city attorney Borgholt. The Berkeley city lawyer said members of the group scribbled suicide messages on sidewalks near a public high school. One message, she said, dared a parent, give me $5,000 and I'll stop writing about suicide on the sidewalks. According to Borgholt, the homeless campers also smeared feces on the entry doors to City Hall more than once. Was the city really expected to do nothing about that kind of behavior, she asked. Now, of course, whenever anybody raises these issues about a campsite, my immediate response is, well, I know I might actually find some way of justifying this kind of behavior under certain circumstances. If there's no bathrooms, you may want to bring bags of shit to the city council to let them, encourage them to open up the bathrooms that need to be there, so homeless people don't have to take a crap in the bushes, and house people don't have to deal with piles of shit in their neighborhoods. Well, you might also, once you've tried, you know, the reasonable approach, hey, we need a bathroom, and you get no response, or you get, we're appointing a commission to study it for some years, or we'll get back to you sometime this summer, as the city council here in Santa Cruz has said, after council member Glover tried to get some action in January. At first, he couldn't get it on the agenda. Then when he finally forced it on the agenda, it got postponed for 3 months. And actually, it's going to be postponed further, I believe. The issue is, if somebody is committing a crime and you really feel it's significant, like you want to arrest someone for writing something on the sidewalk that talks about, I don't know, the high suicide rate among homeless people and puts it in the form of a dare, and you think that they should, instead of dealing with the issue of suicide, you should go after the person for writing the message. All right, well, find a law that criminalizes that, but don't attempt to arrest everyone in the encampment or drive people away at night and make them all unsafe. I mean, this is pretty elementary kind of stuff, this kind of analysis. It doesn't take a lot of brains or deep logic to get to this conclusion, I think. But these are the kind of arguments used by anti-homeless folks or by cities trying to defend, city attorneys trying to defend anti-homeless behavior. Continuing the story, but three named plaintiffs, Clark Sullivan, Adam Bredenberg, and Benjamin Royer, tell a different story. City civil rights attorney Dan Siegel of Siegel, Yee, Brunner, and Mehta in Oakland said the city declined to give homeless campers sanitary facilities or hand washing stations or showers or garbage pickup, as they now do in Santa Cruz. You may remember they did provide them at the Ross Camp. But when the Ross Camp was dispersed, with only a fraction of that number going in any kind of shelter, either at River Street, 7th Avenue, or Laurel, all the rest of the campers are expected to just, I don't know, build their own bathrooms, hold their water all night, avoid taking a shit except when they can, you know, beg their way into public facilities at restaurants or in get into public facilities during the day. It's weird. It's not, of course. It's standard because it's part of this strange, twisted, cruel mentality that if you only are harsh enough to people, they will all disappear. And that's what you really want to happen. We don't have sanitary facilities, washing stations, showers, or garbage pickup for homeless people in Santa Cruz for the overwhelming majority of those folks. And it's not just Berkeley, which this story is really about. It's about Santa Cruz and other cities, but most particularly it's about us. Or that's what I would be encouraging you to think about as you hear this. Bergalt, the city attorney, questioned the motives for organizing protest camps, saying it enabled the group to exploit the term protest as a get-out-of-jail-free card for illegal camping. Where does the shelter end and the expression begin? Bergalt asked. And of course, none of them are talking about the Martin versus Boise decision because, again, during the time covering this lawsuit, which is, again, a bunch of homeless people, as we are doing here in Santa Cruz, suing the city for damages, for the damages they suffered because the city destroyed their encampments, quite similar to the Ross camp. Only the difference here is they are arguing it's a free speech issue, whereas the Ross Camp defendants in the Desiree Quintero case, as it's called here, are arguing that they were putting homeless people at risk. It's probably also true in Berkeley, but they're not making that argument in the case of these three defendants, or I should say plaintiffs, who are Clark Sullivan, Adam Bredenberg, and Benjamin Royer. Berkeley also denies it seized and dumped homeless people's possessions during encampment sweeps. The city promised to keep valuable unattended property in storage for up to 90 days. Of course, the Santa Cruz police made similar promises about Ross Camp. But if you went out there the day or two or three or four after the camp was fenced off and people were banned from coming back to get their property except during a narrow window between 9 and 12 on the Monday following the Friday closing, you would see massive amounts of property being bulldozed and crushed, including what seemed to be usable items. Now, I couldn't get in there. I didn't get in there. I didn't attempt to jump the fence and analyze it, perhaps as a good reporter should. But it looked to me like a lot of stuff that people couldn't carry away. They didn't have the wherewithal to do it or the place to take it to. Their property was destroyed by the Santa Cruz City. And that, of course, is one of the claims being made here in this lawsuit in Berkeley by these three plaintiffs. But the plaintiffs say they lost essential equipment like tents, sleeping bags, cell phones, and cooking equipment despite trying to retrieve their property from the city. It's a failure by the city to safely take custody of, store, and return to homeless people property that was taken during these raids, Siegel, their attorney, said. Taking the stand as the first witness Monday, former police lieutenant Andrew Rattiever said he was involved with hundreds of homeless encampment sweeps during his 30-year career with the Berkeley Police Department from 1988 to 2018. Failing to directly answer the same question posed in different ways, Rattiever begrudgingly acknowledged homeless people are not allowed to camp anywhere in the city. Siegel asked the former police lieutenant if he ever told homeless campers where they could go after he forced them to pack up their stuff and leave a location. No, we did not, Rattiever said, adding the police did ask if people needed help and sometimes referred them to a shelter. Of course, shelters were, I don't know if there's any evidence presented, but in Santa Cruz, it's generally the case the shelters are either full or if they're not full, they can't accommodate the number of people that are being evicted. Or if they can't accommodate some of them, other circumstances make the shelters unusable for them because of distance, because of jobs, because of drug use, where they're not allowed to, and they are addicted to drugs, and so their choices are limited there. The trial is expected to continue until May 30th. That's the story. Jury must decide if Berkeley retaliated against homeless for speech, and it's in a newspaper or on an online publication called Courthouse News Service. And then there's a second story. Witnesses recount aggressive raids on Berkeley homeless camps. The next day, on the 21st, again by Nicholas Yoving, again from the Courthouse News Service, on the second day of a trial over claims that Berkeley, California targeted homeless campers for their speech, witnesses Tuesday described how police repeatedly raided their camps and seized their property as they grew more vocal in opposing city policies. I felt we were being harassed because we were doing political work, said Clark Sullivan, a homeless Berkeley resident and lead plaintiff in the suit against the city. We were being singled out to get us to stop, he added. Sullivan, a 58-year-old man with health problems and limited mobility, said he was live-streaming a police raid when city workers snatched his purple suitcase and threw it in the back of a truck. When he retrieved the luggage from a city storage unit months later, he said the clothing inside was ruined and covered in mildew. Sullivan is one of four former and current homeless campers who testified Tuesday about the city's aggressive crackdown on homeless activists' encampments between October 2016 and January 2017. The city says the camps were targeted for health and safety reasons, which of course was the pretext used in Santa Cruz, not to retaliate against the group's political activism. Also testifying Tuesday was Mike Zint, co-founder of First They Came for the Homeless, I mentioned him earlier, a group that organized multiple drug-free encampments in prominent spots around Berkeley to raise awareness about homelessness and affordable housing issues. Zint, who is not a plaintiff in the case, told jurors he lost everything he owned in a November 2016 raid outside of Berkeley City Hall. Zint said he was arrested because police decided he wasn't moving fast enough after they woke him up at 4:30 a.m. and ordered him to start packing. "The police were trying to force me to move before my medication had an opportunity to take effect," Zint said. U.S. District Judge William Alsup told the jury to disregard testimony about Zint's lost possessions because he is not one of the three plaintiffs with claims of lost or damaged property against the city. The issue might arise in the minds of a juror, and I would wonder why William Alsup would find this illegitimate, the judge, that if they can disregard his property, then they might also be disregarding the property of the plaintiffs. It might be a practice. It might be a habit. It might be a preference, even. Who knows? Plaintiffs Benjamin Royer and Adam Bredenberg also described losing property in camp sweeps or finding other people's tents discarded in dumpsters after police raids. On cross-examination, Berkeley Deputy City Attorney Lynn Burgalt challenged the notion that police acted as villains when clearing encampments. She noted that police officers offered to help campers move their stuff and sometimes brought them coffee and donuts. Burgalt asked the four witnesses if they ever heard city officials say why they were clearing their camps. The reasons given were in written notices stating that the camps were unsanitary or in violation of laws that prohibit lodging on public property, according to the witnesses. A brief aside here, one of the things that activists are now trying to do, given the Boise versus Martin decision that says you can't use Santa Cruz's sleeping ban or camping ordinances to go after people, but you can. Police are still moving a hell of a lot of people around town, threatening them and their property, doing ID checks, warrant checks, and searches on them, and making their lives uncomfortable and making them feel like criminals for simply being homeless on the streets. And the pretext for this are laws that are supposedly being violated, whether it's blocking the sidewalk, being in a park after dark, being in a property that's closed off. And we're not talking about private property here. We're talking about public property, much of which is now closed to the public during a lot of the times when previously it had been open, like City Hall, which used to be open 24 hours a day, not the building, but the grounds around it, or the police station, not the building, but the grounds around it, and similarly with the library. Or just being on public property, and the claim then becomes you are illegally lodging if you are sitting there at night, maybe covered up with a blanket or maybe with a tent against the rain or under an awning. And there again, you may be accused of being on private property in the rain because the owner of the store, even though the store is closed, nobody's there. And you would wonder who would give a shit. They are still, the police are still feel they have the right to or the responsibility to go over there and drive people out into the rain with no legal place to go because they're violating the laws. In other words, the issue becomes for us, some of us homeless activists, how do we make sure that these new laws, stay away ordinances in the parks, being in a park after dark, being in a closed area, blocking the sidewalk, public nuisance, all these things that don't have anything to do with substantial crimes, but are really sort of another verbalization of the sleeping ban, but verbalized in such a way that they don't, in a clear, explicit way, violate the court's rulings around the Boise versus Martin rights that were seemed to have been sort of established by that decision, at least for the moment. Continuing with this story, attorney also questioned in Berkeley whether the homeless plaintiffs made good faith efforts to retrieve their belongings from the city following camp evictions. Did you ever think, gee, that property is really important to me, I better go figure out how to get it back, Bergalt said. Royer, a 33-year-old homeless man with severe back pain and limited mobility, said he relied on other members of the group to help him retrieve a sleeping bag, tarp, and tools he used for a wheelchair, which were lost in a raid. I don't remember if I was told or why they could not find my property, Royer said. I believe I asked on numerous occasions. Now, in Santa Cruz, the only way you can get your property back from the police, assuming that they're not charging you with a crime for being on the sidewalk or being homeless outside in a park after dark, is if the DA or the city attorney has dropped any charges against you or is not filing charges against you. And, of course, there are many, many charges being filed, the statements by Chief Mills notwithstanding his claims that we've stopped enforcing the sleeping ban, tickets are way down. He doesn't mention the tickets are way up for being in a park after dark, violation of the being in a closed area rules or the de facto trespassing, no trespassing rules. If your property has been taken by the police and they say, oh, okay, we're not going to charge you, come and get your property, you have to show up during a very narrow interval, Tuesdays or Thursdays between 12:30 and 2:30 are the only times that our police department allows people to pick up their property. That at least is the last I heard of it within the last month or two. And I don't think that's changed. I think I would have heard of it if that whole had changed. And I certainly hope, Chief Mills, if you're listening to this broadcast, that you're changing it tomorrow, if not yesterday. Particularly important for people whose survival cure you're holding. More important with the destruction of the Ross camp, I theorize, and I'm not speaking because people have come to me talking to me about this, but this is just my thought, my speculation. Because people who are supportive or were supportive of the Ross camp, different churches, the Democratic Socialists, Food Not Bombs, Huff, other groups, the California Homeless Union can't get to these people anymore with the ease they used to because they're scattered all over the city and all over the county now. And that being the case, it's much more difficult to provide them with tents and survival gear and clothing if that's what people want to do because they're no longer, at least one large group of them, is no longer in one place. Now, again, as I always have said, 300 people at the Ross camp is still only a fraction of 1,000 to 2,000 people in the city, homeless people in the city. So that has to be considered as well. Bergalt, the Berkeley city attorney, also asked about claims that the group smeared feces on the entrance of City Hall and scribbled suicide messages on a sidewalk near Berkeley High School. Zint said the city has no evidence that his group spattered poop on the entry doors of City Hall. However, Sullivan admitted the group poured and red paint on the steps of the building. Zint said the suicidal chalk writings were written by a group member suffering from mental health problems. The disturbing messages were not endorsed by the group, he added. When asked why that person was not ejected from camp, Zint said he would never abandon a person with mental health problems who needed help. I'm not going to kick a suicidal man out of his support network, Zint said. According to Zint, the group organized protest camps with the goal of persuading the city to establish a sanctioned camp on a piece of public property with toilets, trash pickup, and other city services. All four witnesses testified Tuesday that they believe police targeted them for protesting in prominent places, speaking out at city council meetings, and writing opinion pieces critical of city government. All too often, people who are homeless are dehumanized because their whole existence is seen as against the law, Sullivan told jurors. We wanted to show that we have rights and that we are the same as anybody else. Though his calendar indicates the trial may go through May 30th, Alsup, the judge, said Tuesday that he expects both sides to finish presenting evidence by Friday. Berkeley City Manager D. Williams Ridley, who started testifying at the end of the day Tuesday, is expected to continue her testimony Wednesday. Don't have any stories from yesterday, Wednesday's court actions, or court actions today on Thursday, the 23rd. But hopefully I will on Sunday if the news media gives them to me. I'll also perhaps have an interview with Mike Zint if I can get through to him. Let's take a musical break. Rhiannon Giddens, Cry No More. Video has essentially takes place in a church, if you look at the video online, and it shows folks coming out of the different seats, joining the choir, and then being led by a woman with a drum who's beating it, We Don't Cry No More. And at the end of that whole video, there's a logo that says, Know Your History, Know Your Mind, Speak Up, Be Loud.